Computer, this is Data.
I'm an android. I'm
Rangers League basketball.
I was processing all of the information.
Processing.
It's one of those idiots who believe in analytics.
Rangers League basketball.
Analytics was crap.
Does not compute.
Just because you got good stats doesn't mean you're a good team.
Hello and welcome back to the Lakers Exceptionalism Podcast. My name is Tom Z, joined as always by my man Tim, aka Cranjus McBasketball. And Tim, we are coming off of the tale of two games here where played the Boston Celtics pretty close for most of the game, got blown out, and then trolled them a little in the fourth quarter, made them put their starters back in, and then played a tight game against Utah, got a little bit of a lead on them, and they trolled us, and they came back and pushed it to overtime, but the Lakers eventually closed that one out. We're recording this Monday morning Pacific time, so we do face the Jazz one more time. No AD. I do believe some of the Jazz main guys, Gobert, Conley, will probably be back, so this one's probably looking like an L, but it was nice to get that extra win at least. And we'll dive into the games a little bit deeper here, just a little kind of recap. But what did you see from these last couple games other than Jalen Michael Jordan Brown?
Yeah, that wing defense has me a little bit worried, and obviously it's not the full Lakers team. I've over this bigger picture stretch without Braun, without AD, I think the team's fared pretty well. And a couple weeks ago, I was planning out like, all right, this will be a win, that'll be a loss. This one, maybe that's a loss. And we've gained, I think, two extra games over what I was expecting. The Brooklyn win, which was helped by some injuries, and then Kyrie Irving going out in the game, and then like KD had just come back from injury, so they were just kind of rudderless. So that one was.
Where'd you have the Knicks nice game? Did you have that in the winnable column?
I had the Knicks game as a winnable game. Charlotte, I had as winnable, but it became much more winnable after the injuries. And then I'm forgetting the other game that we picked. Oh, the Utah game. Mm-hmm. That, like, I was not expecting you. So the Lakers have been fortunate with some guys resting and being injured on other teams in terms of the schedule looking easier than it did on paper. But I don't know. They're getting through it. Reinforcements are coming soon. We're seeing McLemore get more and more integrated. He was a big piece of that bench group that came back against the Celtics towards the end of the game. So we got to see him like shoot some twos instead of just like being a spot up guy. We have seen more and more of Drummond, and the Drummond experience is really an experience because he'll do some like really amazing things and then some really terrible things in the same play or sandwiched in other plays. I know you had some comments on Twitter, and we're seeing some things that like it's just the highs are high and the lows are low, and you see the potential, but then you see the frustration like 10 seconds later. So it's certainly an experience.
There's like an Andre Drummond song that played in the first quarter against the Jazz. And the first note was a drum solo with him getting the steal all the way for a dunk. You know, right in the middle there is him standing at the left like elbow and just watching Jordan Clarkson run from the 3-point in straight for a layup. And then on the back end, you know, he comes back with another drum solo, as I've called it, where he just takes the ball from somebody and takes it all the way down the court, and or drum break, you know, shouts to Nick from Locked On Mavs for that. I like the drum break for the, you know, but it's actually hilarious to watch him, you know, and you finally, you know, open Harrison Fagan's eyes and he's seeing Andre Drummond not put bodies on guys. But all in all, I would still say he, you know, had a pretty decent game, not really against, but he didn't play against Boston, right?
Correct.
But against the Jazz, he's had his best game, I think, as a Laker, like 25 points, 27 points.
Yeah, 27 points, 8 rebounds, 3 assists. He started off cold with a couple turnovers, was missing some bunnies, but he finished 10 for 15, added 7 free throws, a couple steals, like you mentioned. And not just like, you know, steals, then the team walks up in transition or walks up in the half court. These are like coast to coast. He's picking dudes off and then finishing strong on the other end. So those are, that's, you know, a stop plus 2 free points. So really impactful stuff there. He was a team high plus 18. In that win over Utah. But like you mentioned, in the Boston game, he was unavailable. Marc Gasol started, played pretty well, was hitting all of his shots. Still, like everyone else, finished like minus 20 or something like that, other than the deep bench guys. But it's good to see that he's still kind of staying ready, staying engaged. So I don't know. I think we've had a couple strong performances from the different centers, and you just have to keep them, you know, continue to integrate Drummond. and keep Mark ready because he's going to be needed at some point in the playoffs. And I think right now, more so due to like injury situations than like purposeful, you know, platooning, we've gotten to see them both play. But I saw that as a pro. I saw the wing defense this past week as something that's still kind of glaring a little bit. And my confidence in Wes Matthews goes up and down. But that Jaylen Brown, what he did against in that Celtics game was a little bit concerning. But, you know, we're past that. Hopefully the Lakers can put up a fight in tonight's game. By the time you're listening to this, it may be over. And I think if the Lakers do win this game, it would be the most impressive victory we've seen since LeBron went out. Because this is a team with their players playing without a bunch of key injuries. Like, they're missing some dudes. But for the most part, this first-ranked team in the West has most of its key pieces playing. So this wouldn't be like beating a Nets team that like has KD on like what, his first or second game back and missing Harden, missing Kyrie. Like this would be a really impressive victory if the Lakers could pull it out tonight.
All right, Tim. So other stuff we're going to talk about. We're going to talk more Utah today. We're going to take Utah and Phoenix in the playoff matchup. We're each going to take a side and discuss that later. But we did have, forgive me if I don't have your name right up now. Somebody hit us up during the game asking us during the Boston game whether or not we were happy not to have faced the Celtics in the finals last year. We were on this podcast. We kind of said that in so many words, the wing stopper defense. This is slightly different roster, but still kind of same issues. You know, to me, it's seeing Jaylen Brown, who's definitely improved even from last year in the bubble, get to his spots, not only beat people with speed, but with physicality. You know, if it's KCP, he's going to outpower them. If it's Wes Matthews, he's going to beat them with his foot speed and quickness. So does that, and I guess I'm trying to make this less about Boston, more about the two wings. Hey, there's another team in the Western Conference with two superstar wings, Tim. Does this concern you at all? Just kind of before we touch on the Clippers, is this kind of a potential reason you might be more, not scared, but more worried about a Clippers matchup in the playoffs?
Yeah, there are certain teams the Lakers match up better against than others. And as we're digging into these, like, you know, play this team or that team, we're getting to dive into that a little bit deeper. I think conceptually, the wing scoring piece of it is something that is a concern of mine. And when a team only has one scoring wing, that's one thing. When they have multiple and you've got to deal with Tatum and Jaylen Brown, that's another thing. So even if Wes is doing a great job, he's got one of those guys. And then you have the other one that you have to worry about. And so you can put LeBron out there, but LeBron's somebody that the Lakers have been keeping away from difficult matchups this season. And his job has been more that helper, that center field, that's free safety, like cleaning things up. Do you stick him on those on ball wing creation types of guys? Does AD do that? And if AD does that, then you suddenly don't like, are you playing small with him at your five, or do you have another center out there, but you're playing AD as a wing defender? It's not optimizing him in his best role. Putting LeBron on those guys isn't him in his best role. So like, you want to have a Wes Matthews kind of guy that can slot into that job so that the other two dudes can be their best versions of themselves and not have to be fighting that battle. Like Wes Matthews, he can exert most of his energy. You talked about the other pod, spending your like energy bar. Familiar with lots of video games where that matters, your stamina. And if you're a dude on defense that wing stopper gonna go fight and make life as difficult as possible for these scoring wings, offensively, a lot of times those dudes are like stationary shooters or movement shooters. Like, it's a low, like, you are being asked to do a ton on one end and not much on the other. And that helps you really exert yourself and be the best version of yourself defensively. If AD and LeBron are those guys, that probably takes a little bit away from their offense. And we're seeing right now, we've been seeing for the past month or two, what that can look like when those guys aren't out there or aren't their best selves. So that's just another element of, I think, this big puzzle. And the two teams we're going to talk about today don't really have that element to their offenses. But I mean, last year it was the same way. Clippers and Boston, those were the two teams that just like, you know, we have this kind of guy to stop your we had a Dwight to stop your post players. We have all these guard defenders to stop your guard scores. We didn't quite have those dedicated wing stoppers. And this year it's a little bit better. We've got Wes, but it's still for the most part the same kind of situation. So that the multiple wing scoring teams are the ones that I would worry a little bit more about. So again, the Clippers, again, Boston. I'm trying to think of who else would fit into that category, but that's the type of team. They may not beat LA, but they will give us more difficulty than other teams just because we don't have the right tools in the toolbox or enough of the right tools in the toolbox to be optimized as a defense and playing the way we've seen the team play.
Yeah, and we'll get to more of this, like I said, when we get to the Clippers. I think the Lakers have the ability to do a couple of weird things with their lineups. Like the other night against the Jazz, they were playing like four guards and Montrezl Harrell. And we've kind of seen before some of these weird lineups where like Kyle Kuzma is the effective shooting guard. So if they wanted to shift Bron and AD out of some situations where they're not the primary, you know, Kawhi, Paul George defenders, you can maybe, you know, cross matchups switch a little bit and hope Kyle Kuzma or, you know, someone, Wes Matthews, Markieff Morris can become these primary guys to stop them. But it's the answer I'm most concerned about in terms of these other, you know, counter adjustments for these playoff matchups the Lakers could face. But just jumping around a little bit here, Tim, I want to bring up a couple observations.
One last thing in the Celtics game. I'm looking through the matchup data. Guess who defended Jason Tatum, who had a quieter night than his colleague Jaylen Brown?
Kyle Kuzma?
No, that was actually Wes Matthews. McKinney got about a minute, and then Kuz was the third most used defender on Tatum. For Jaylen Brown, it was KCP. It was THT. Those were the top guys that he was going up against and putting points up against.
Way too small.
I think that just and we saw Tatum, he had an okay game, but Brown was the one who really went off. And even if we do believe in Wes as that wing stopper, he's only able to, you know, defend one guy at a time. So that I just wanted to go check the matchup data from NBA.com. Yeah. Felt I'd throw that out there. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's all good. I was going to say, just go to some random observations, Tim. We've been talking a little bit about Andre Drummond, his pick and roll coverages, what those have looked like. It hasn't been, I'll say, it hasn't been amazing on the catch edges. He's definitely slow in like that peel back to his man, where you see Trez is really good, actually, and better than I think both of us anticipated with his intensity at kind of peeling back to his guy. But there was a kind of side pick and roll there, I think in the third quarter, where I think it's Clarkson and Ilyasova, I believe, but I could be mistaken. It was a pop, right? So they side pick and roll. The picker pops. You know, Andre Drummond kind of steps in front to.
Yeah, he's there to contain for a second until that guard gets back. Yeah.
And since that guy popped, you know, Drummond can't just like step over and tag and get back to his guy. So what they did was they send the two guys from the weak side, they shift them one person up so the guy in the corner is open, and then Drummond would peel off. And he sprinted into it, which is one of the things that I like to see, and that's kind of the buy-in that I expect from a Frank Vogel defense now. If you're going to be on the court, you got to sprint into rotations. And I think they got a crazy, like, Royce O'Neal three at the, you know, end of the shot clock that was a prayer, but 24 seconds of good defense, got the ball out of Clarkson's hand in not attacking position. They couldn't get the shot from the pop from Ilyasova. So it was just a really creative way of like, to me, that's like, this is how Frank knows how to use his tools in his tool bag, you know?
Yeah. And that was a lot of times when we're like, oh man, I wish the Lakers did this. People will be like, oh, well, you don't want to let the other team see what you're going to do. You have to hide all your secrets. And usually it's about like really simple stuff like switching or like really like stuff that you don't need to hide. This was creative. This I thought was really neat, because this was like, this is straight out of, if you're at your computer right now, go open up a tab and Google the Swarm Defense by Wayne Walters. It's a, he was a, I think, Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, like a D2 school, super creative man-to-man. Well, not, it's sort of a man-to-man defense at like the lower level, college level, where anytime a ball screen would be run, the next defender would go take that, and then everybody else would just kind of rotate like clockwise behind it or counterclockwise behind it. This was kind of like that, where you just kind of like, you know, the next man's going to come over, and then the next perimeter player is going to bounce up, and then you as the big man, instead of having to recover in a harder way, you can just go peel out to that weak side corner. So I don't know. It's some unique stuff. I thought it was pretty creative. I would imagine that now that teams have it on tape, they could be more prepared for it, or it might just be something that chews up some practice time. But that's the kind of creativity and you know, acumen on the defensive end of the court that I really appreciate seeing from this staff. And like, there are a bunch of creative things you can do on offense, and the Lakers are more vanilla there, but defensively, which is an area a lot of people think is pretty vanilla, the Lakers are being more creative, and that's really cool. So that was neat to see. I think it shows us that the team is thinking in more nuanced terms about like, all right, like, how can we best optimize Dre? How can we, you know, defend pick and pops differently from pick and rolls? And all of those sorts of things are the right questions. And that just shows us that this team is just so prepared defensively. And that's part of why they've been so good without LeBron and without AD, because everybody's on the same page. They're game planning very, very well. They're executing very, very well. And this is just an extension of that. So I'm pleased. I think, like you said, the catch edges themselves have been like, they've been okay. They're not excellent. They're not as bad as what I saw in film a couple years ago. And shame on me for using like 3 year old data and film on Andre Drummond showing Harden recovering or running catch edges to say that he couldn't do it anymore. So I'll take my L there. I think he's much better than I was anticipating. But we're still seeing the team use some of these workarounds to maybe, you know, finagle how exactly he fits into the defensive scheme. But I am certainly more impressed with his defense than I was anticipating from like a ball screen mobility standpoint, because there's some things he's shown he could do, but this was one of those question marks, and he's really stepped up to the plate and played really well.
Yeah, and I love the way you frame that, because to me, it's a sign that Vogel didn't and his staff didn't just accept Andre Drummond for the player he is and say, you know, this is all right, well, we're dropping every time he's in now, like that's the new scheme. So, you know, he's like we thought, like I thought, at least I was optimistic they would bring Drummond closer to the system than the other way around.
Yeah. And why that's so important is the system that they use now is translatable to the playoffs much more so than the drop scheme that Drummond was running in the past. So if he couldn't adapt, and this was our chance to see if he could adapt or not, he's not making it into these playoff rotations. Mm-hmm. He's not out there defending Chris Paul and Devin Booker and all of these guards that can shoot those pull-up jumpers. That's gonna be troublesome. Jordan Clarkson, Mike Conley. Like, that is where you need to run those catch edges or switch or something. Yeah. You can't be running drop coverage.
See, the thing is, I guess we'll get to this on the back half, but I don't know if Andre Drummond is going to play 20 minutes a night in the Utah playoff series, in Utah specifically.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so either, but I think he's shown enough that
those 20 minutes will kill you.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you can't, like, it'll be like below average catch hedging, but it's enough that you can put him out there and can get the pros that he brings you with some of the cons mitigated. And I mean, now the other big question is, how does he fit in the offense when you've got LeBron and AD out there? If they're able to fit all the pieces together where he's still like facilitating and using his roll gravity and all that, that's good. If it just turns into stand in the opposite dunker spot and just finish dump offs and try to get offensive rebounds, you take away most of the benefits that he's been giving the team over this recent stretch of games. And that, I mean, it could work. He's certainly going to get better looks than he did in Cleveland. But if he's underperforming on good looks the same way he did in Cleveland and the same way he's done in the past, that's where I have angst about playing him over like a Harrell or somebody who can, you know, just finish well.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to throw out a couple of the small things I noticed the last couple games. Not a huge thing, but Alex Caruso's passing, like, again, not really reflected always in the raw numbers and like not in the craziest assist numbers or anything, but just kind of the confidence with which he's making the right read, the quickness with the way he's hitting some of the pocket passes. Now he'll throw a pocket pass that'll get kicked away easily because it was predictable or something, but there's some chemistry there with him and Trez. I don't know, just something for me to keep my eye on. He's still pretty struggled badly on the offensive end, but still making winning plays overall. Anything? I know, you noticed anything about that?
Yeah, so it's been something that just kind of hit me all at once, because we've gone through the stretch where it's guys being asked to do more than they're normally asked to do. So like the expectations were low, and I'm not like hyper analyzing, THT's pick and roll reads or Caruso's pick and roll reads, just because I don't want to like beat down on a guy who's doing more than he needs to be doing. But both of those players have shown tangible growth when it comes to their playmaking. And I think that's been really important to keep the offense alive somewhat. And just, you know, it's not good that LeBron and AD are injured, but some of the silver lining can be that these other players thrust into larger roles than normal. Caruso, THT, Schroeder a little bit. More Caruso and THT, we've seen the growth and the improvement when it comes to that playmaking in ways that once the team is fully healthy and those guys are slotted back into roles where less is expected of them, we should still reap some of that benefit where like the ball moving is better, or like we run our strong side pick and roll and then there's a kick out and then it turns into a secondary pick and roll. And that's where Caruso or THT are able to beat down a defense that's already warped and manipulated more so than them being like the focal point of the offense. So I'll say in the data, we see that growth. And it took me like looking at the data now compared to some of the older data to notice it. But the quality's up, the versatility's up, the volume of course is up, the efficiency's in a good spot. So Caruso and THT, neither of which are, you know, excellent first tier playmakers or anything like that, but they've certainly shown some growth. And I think this experience, this learning experience, and them making strides has been really helpful, because other guys have been thrown into roles larger than them and haven't gained that growth. Like Schroeder's struggled from an efficiency standpoint. Actually, recently he's limited the turnovers, and if he can be that version of himself, that's really helpful moving forward. But for the most part, he's struggled in terms of playmaking and doing so without turning the ball over. But those other two guys, I think, like you mentioned, have really taken a step up. So I want to give them their flowers.
Yeah, so that was actually my next kind of quick hitter question was Schroeder has been a much bigger, you know, part of the offense ever since LeBron and AD went out. It's been up and down. His assist numbers are up, but as are the turnovers. And it's not just the number of turnovers, it's the kind of turnovers. And he spoke about like just lazy passes, I think is how he put it. So he's cleaned that up quite a bit. And I guess for me, it's the bigger, broader, does this worry you in the playoffs as far as crunch time? We did see him kind of get beat on that game-winning slip a potentially game-winning slip from Jordan Clarkson. But then he came right back down and targeted Ilias over and over until he fouled out in overtime. So there's some good there. There's some bad there. Is it going to be a mixed bag, you think, going forward? Or do you think that some of this turnover stuff he might, you know, have learned from, and this could help him in the playoffs as well?
I'd say the best potential answer is it's going to be somewhere in between, and hopefully he's growing a little bit, but it's not going to go from really poor passing efficiency to suddenly excellent without tangible drop-offs in other ways. Like, all right, well, he's not turning the ball over because he's not attempting skip passes anymore, or he's not trying to hit the roll man, or that pocket pass that used to be something he'd complete a decent amount of the time, now he's not even going for. So that's where like we have to monitor, and I don't have an answer for this right now, but monitor how his behavior has changed. Is it he's cutting out a specific type of pass, or is he just getting better at threading needles? I think that's where I'll want to monitor with his game, because turnovers are bad, but when you're thrown into those playmaking roles, turnovers are expected when you are needing to make those more difficult passes. So you have to find the right balance. And that's why just looking at like passing turnover rates isn't the best way to say a guy's good or bad at passing, because it's just, it comes with the territory. But certainly for Schroeder, it's been a little bit more than you'd want. So I think he'll hopefully be a little bit better, but I'd say we're probably closer to the large sample of Schroeder than the couple game sample of Schroeder if we're trying to look forward.
All right. I just, it was promising to know the Jazz were undermanned, and, you know, it was a wonky game, but he put in some clutch possessions that that changed the game. And then the Lakers finally put their foot on the gas in overtime and you know, got that 12-point victory. I got to say, I had the Lakers minus 1.5. When I saw Gobert and Conley and all them were out, and I was like, oh, what did they just basically have to win. And at the end, I was like, are you actually kidding me, Lakers? Like, you actually, okay. No, that's neither here nor there.
Utah's coached well. Utah is coached very well.
Ersan Ilyasova going like 6-for-8 from three is just, come on. He's played 8 games for them. It's the weekly, you know, role player who plays like an MVP candidate against the Lakers. Mm-hmm. It's just very tilting. But let's take a quick break and we'll get more into Utah and Phoenix and them as potential matchups, and maybe take a Discord question later as well.
If you're a basketball junkie, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Twice a week, JJ Redick is cooking on his podcast, The Old Man and the Three. He has guys come on in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, including Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron in Miami, and the moment Tyrese Halliburton knew Pascal Siakam would be a good fit in Indy. In addition to player interviews, every Monday, JJ breaks down the top three things happening around the NBA with unmatched analysis, not outlandish takes, and is often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler to dive deep on rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? You won't find another outlet that covers the game as comprehensively and with such insight as JJ does it on The Old Man and the Three. Make this your companion podcast during the playoffs. Listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. Tim, Utah, Phoenix. We just saw an undermanned Utah team. That said, still pretty deadly, right? Utah's offense moves the ball. Like, they're getting good shots. There was one particular, like, three-man game they had on the right wing where they passed from right wing to, like, right block to right corner. And it's just kind of an example of them getting great shots with just really unselfish but not overpassing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Leno Gobert. Gobert against Drummond in the playoffs kind of worries me. Gobert against Gasol, I'm intrigued. Pick and pop partner, that's a perfect thing way to kill that drop coverage, right? So Is this a case where if we just place the right pieces against Utah, they're, you know, mortal against us? Or do you think that, like, no matter who the Lakers have on the court, the Jazz can just shoot themselves into a game or two or three or four?
I always think that given how they're coached, this team can give you, I mean, it's going to be a fight. It's not going to be easy. This isn't, you can't look at Rudy Gobert and say, he's an anchor big. They usually lose value in the playoffs. Therefore, you know, he's going to stink all of a sudden. Like, you have to put him in those situations to challenge him. And the Lakers offense isn't set up from like a pick and roll ball handler standpoint to require Gobert to start catch hedging or showing and recovering or blitzing or anything like that. You're not doing that against Alex Crusoe or THT or LeBron James or Dennis Schroeder. Those are guys that you, for the most part, you can drop against. And like you mentioned, when Drummond's out there, we'll say Trez is out there, even AD to a certain extent, if they're just rolling, Gobert's one of the few guys in the league that can, like, he's so long, he's mobile enough in ball screen type situations, he can contest your shot if you pull up, or he can get back for that lob. And their guards are excellent. They'll get a lot of back pressure in those. So, like, they're really good at what they do, and you need to just kind of get them out of it. It's going to be a tough matchup. I love Utah's offense, and I describe it, and I think it's been described years ago as, I think Quinn Snyder called it advantage basketball. And I love that term because it's not some, like, I don't know. A lot of times you'll hear about Utah's offense, like some system that's like mystical and like everybody's running these like football plays where it's simple. It's using Gobert's roll gravity, using the 3-point shooting gravity, and using the ball handling that they have on that team and good just ball mover playmaking to put the defense in tough spots, make a defender be wrong, and just choose between two options, either the lobs there or the pull-up shots there or the kick-out threes there. And they try to put playmakers in situations where they only have a couple simple reads to make. And it's a lot of three-man game. It'll look like two-man game. It's a lot of stuff that looks similar. And we've seen with the Lakers offense, when their key guys get out, now we're seeing players thrust into roles that they're not used to. With Utah's offense, when their key guys go out, they're still running the same plays. So they're still comfortable. They're still able to do what they're normally doing and what they're practicing to do every day. So it's easier for that team to succeed in that way. In a playoff series, I think I'd still – so for the purpose of this argument, I don't agree with this. I would much rather play Phoenix, but today I drew the short straw, and I'm going to say I'd rather play Utah. And I'll start with, I think, the thing that anybody would start with. They don't have those ISO scores. They don't have that superstar. They have some good players. They have a defensive superstar. They don't have an offensive superstar.
And but Tim, Donovan Mitchell.
Donovan Mitchell is good at basketball, but he's not a superstar. I think he can give you stretches of that level of play. I think in the playoffs, we've seen him, like when they played Denver against that okay defense last playoffs, he was looking really good.
Until Gary Harris got on his ass.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. We have a couple guys that can get on his ass with this team. This isn't a team with wing scoring. They're not like Gobert's not beating up anybody in the post. He's 5-for-14 on the season in the post. This is a team that you worry about the shooting. They have a very legit ball screen offense. They're going to try to put you in situations where they get those lobs. But I'd go out there and start switching stuff. I'd say, all right, Gobert, you're not getting behind us. You're not catching any lobs. You're going to go post up Wes Matthews and show me that you can make hook shots over and over and over again, because he hasn't done that all year. And yeah, he hasn't been a good post player in the past. When we look at their perimeter isolation guys, Bogdanovich isn't good at it. Jordan Clarkson's been a good ball screen guy. He hasn't been a good ISO guy. Mike Conley hasn't been a good ISO guy. Like Donovan Mitchell is that one dude that can score pretty well in ISO, but not at elite levels. And if their team goes from this beautiful system getting open threes and lobs to Donovan Mitchell isolating a bunch, that offense looks way, way less scary than it does. And not every team has the switching personnel, but the Lakers, they've got some mobile bigs. They've got some guards that are can be a little bit beefier. This isn't a team with a bunch of wing scoring. So I like the idea of switching against them, dealing with their built-in switch counters and playing, you know, just good, solid defense and just letting them try to ISO against us.
A couple of things. Utah is better than they were last year in the bubble, all of that. No Bogdanovich for them in the bubble. First half, you know, year with Jordan Clarkson. Mark Conley, obviously, much better in his second year with Utah than his first. But I think there's scenarios where with each guy, so with Mike Conley, right? If you're matching up against him, he's the kind of guy where you're like, I want you to score to beat us. I can't let you, you know, facilitate the offense and get Royce O'Neal and Joe Ingles and Bojan Bogdanovic open threes in the corner, because they're great from getting shots in the corner, right? Great at this. And those guys are part of why. On top of having that vertical threat, right? You got to tag to try and get in Gobert's way. If otherwise it's like 100% 2 points versus 40% 3 points, you know?
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of tough decisions it puts on defense. But if you force Mike Conley to be a scorer, you force Jordan Clarkson to be a passer. And then, you know, the other thing. So here are their fundamentals, Tim, just per cleaning the glass, right? Their first in differential, plus 10.8. Take that with what you will. They should have 45 wins per expected. They have 42. So they have had some struggles this year and some stretches. But overall, their points per 100 possessions, 118.8. Their defense, 108. All of their essentials are good, except in that drop defense isn't an aggressive screen coverage. They don't turn the ball over. Mm-hmm. So I could see a team like the Lakers matching up. Like we saw it in that, I think, third quarter when the Lakers took the game by the horns, turned them over repeatedly. And yes, this isn't the same team, but it's the same kind of concept. That's the Lakers' path to victory. Their defense is better than a good defense in the Jazz. Create those turnovers. And if you can find ways to swarm those rotations the way they were in that last matchup, I'm a lot more optimistic about them not like getting blown out in Montrezl Harrell versus Derek Favors minutes, even though I still don't love that matchup. I'm just less worried about the, you know, oh, okay, well, we're definitely going to be -7 every time this six minute, you know, stretch coming this second comes by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you have some versatility in terms of what you can do with the big man rotation, and in that you can play Gasol and have a pick and pop option, because Gobert's going to be out there. If you just pair Gasol's minutes with the Gobert minutes and you're just pick and popping them to death and trying to counter that that drop coverage, I think that's a just, you know, that's an advantage you're creating for your offense. Trez against Favors, in the second unit isn't a disadvantage to me, and it could potentially be an advantage. But Derek Favors isn't someone who's like adding a ton offensively. He's just part of the system. He's going to finish his dump offs. He's going to get his roles, but he's not going to be like adding a bunch or killing Trez on the boards in ways that other backup bigs for other teams might. This is a team that they're going to be fighting against the teeth of the Laker defense because they don't get out in transition much, and they have the 27th ranked transition efficiency from a points per possession standpoint. So they're not getting free ones. They're not getting easy ones. And like you mentioned, a big part of that is because they don't turn teams over. And that's been a weakness of the Lakers. And it's kind of seemed like LA's going to turn it over no matter who they're playing. But once LeBron and AD are back, once guys are doing their normal jobs, because that's part of it. That's part of it. Once Caruso is doing Caruso's job instead of Dennis Schroeder's job, and Dennis Schroeder's doing his job instead of LeBron's job, it's going to look better from a turnover standpoint. So assuming LA can figure themselves out, integrate the pieces, get healthy, I like playing a low turnover team, and that's Utah. So I think there are a lot of different little things that add up, and you can go small, but Utah can't go small. They're going to have to keep Gobert out there. So AD against Gobert, who is a very good help. I mean, he's the best. He's the best help rim protector. But he is just kind of an okay post defender. And we've seen him be beaten up a little bit in some post matchups against other elite post players. So that's somewhere where maybe AD can do some damage. Or AD as a pick and pop guy, if his threes are falling, that's damaging. Or AD just as a perimeter facilitator. Sit Marcus on the bench, throw AD out there, and have him do those delay sets where he's standing at the top of the key and Rudy Gobert has to stand at the free throw line instead of at the rim, and then get guys curling off of screens and attacking downhill. That, I mean, THT attacking with no Rudy Gobert is an advantage for the Lakers, or LeBron James curling off a screen. Things like that can be good for the Lakers. Favors is a poor post defender. I see Trez being able to attack there. I think there are a lot of small areas that the Lakers can be good. And I think about who does this team have to defend LeBron James? And I think it's really just Royce O'Neal, who's 6'4". Yeah. I think LeBron will bring him down to the post and attack that way. Other than him, they don't really have any wing defense. Like Niang's going to play his bench minutes, and he's an okay defender. Who else do they have? They Ingles. Have Bogdanovich, who's a negative. Ingles is a negative, at least this year from an impact standpoint. So I like LeBron's matchup. Yeah. I like Gasol and AD in 5 minutes. Yeah. I like AD attacking their fours in the post. I like the Lakers post offense against their defense. So it's the idea of Utah, and you can mention, you know, their efficiencies through the roof on offense, on defense, their net rating's great. If you change the situation and you make them be a different team offensively because you're switching, and defensively you have the right personnel to take them out of what they're good at, it's not a top seeded team. And it's not, I think you can argue they're not a top two or three team in the West if you make them play that style of basketball, which most teams can't do, which is why they're so good in right now in the regular season. So it's not a gimme. It's still going to be tough. They're still going to make the most out of their players, but I would feel pretty good about that matchup. I don't know how I feel about Andre Drummond in that matchup, but for Gasol and AD as your 5-man minutes, and then maybe Trez some of those backup five, AD can play four. Like I like, there are enough options that you can try some different things and see what works.
So breaking news, Kredis McBasketball calling the Utah Jazz frauds, headline. But so there's a couple things I want to unpack there that I think are important. So right now, when fully healthy, the Jazz are starting Conley, Mitchell, O'Neal, Bogdanovich, and Gobert. So Ingles is coming off the bench normally. So are you going to guard Anthony Davis with Bojan Bogdanovich? Like, the center position be damned. If it's Marc Gasol, if it's Andre Drummond, if it's Montrezl Harrell, are you going to put Rudy Gobert on AD to start the game? Probably not. The way the Lakers offense, as we've seen during the regular season, during the playoffs, very post-centric, right? So they're going to get Anthony Davis on that high post on a lot of occasions. And yeah, I'm sure they'll probably double. But are you going to double if it's Bogdanovich on him or Gobert? Well, probably Bogdanovich. So all these, like, you know what I mean? These, like, it's like a flow chart of... If then
if kinda, you Yeah, if these guys are defending those players, do this. If not, do that. Like, there's always an answer for the Lakers offense, given their strengths and given the weaknesses of the Jazz players. And a lot of it lines up in a way where you don't let Utah play Utah Jazz basketball on defense. So I think that's really beneficial. Utah's post defense, including pass outs, 28th ranked in the NBA.
Yeah. That's good for us. And so I guess what, in your perfect brain, what's the center rotation look like in a series against the Jazz? Because for me, it's a lot of Gasol and probably a lot of AD and maybe some Trez. But ultimately, Tim, I have to give you, Andre Drummond's playing 15 to 20 minutes no matter what. So this is the restrictions you have to operate from. You have 28 minutes at the center position left over, maybe 33.
You kill me, Tom. Okay.
But you know this is how it goes, right?
This is my answer. Utah has a very consistent rotation. They bring certain guys in and out at specific times. Conley and Gobert's minutes are almost perfectly mirrored. And then Mitchell, Bogdanovich, and O'Neal's minutes are almost perfectly mirrored, that trio. So they do this thing where they get groupings of players together so they can run the same actions with the same groups. Really smart. I love it. Mm-hmm. They, from a backup five standpoint, Favors is coming in at specific points in time, and I would have Andre Drummond out there defending Derek Favors and then attacking Derek Favors in the post in those backup big minutes. If I need to play Drummond, that's how I'm playing Drummond. And then with the remainder of my minutes, we'll say Drummond's getting 15 to 17, so then I have plenty left. I'm going to go... I think you have options. Like, you have... There's a bunch of things you can do.
No, you have too many options.
AD Harrell. Yeah, you could do AD Harrell, and then AD just post up. But then you've got Gobert defending the dunker spot. He's going to come over. So then you're going to need some pin-in flare screens. So that's a... if we figured out the post-help situation, I'm okay with that. If not... If we're not doing well with countering that post help, and Gobert's going to be coming in and blocking shots and causing problems. Although if he is, then Trez is going to be on the boards. There's a lot of if this, then that. If we don't feel comfortable about that, we can just go AD at the five and play small, or go Gasol at the five and play normal. I think a Gasol AD lineup lets you play five out offense. And, you know, go plop Marc Gasol in one corner and Anthony Davis in the other corner. And find out which one Rudy Gobert isn't guarding and put them in some pick and pops or post-ups.
Do you think Rudy Gobert can take advantage of Montrezl Harrell and his lack of size and kind of ability maybe to keep up on the boards with him?
On the boards, yes. I think that is where Trez is going to hurt you. The post-defense doesn't matter against Gobert. He's going to struggle to block lobs thing. Doesn't matter if you're switching ball screens. And if he's catch hedging, like, that's not his job anyway. I wouldn't be catch hedging. Catch hedging against this team stops a lot of their pick and roll ball handler pull-up shots. And they're a very good pull-up three-point shooting team. But it's going to, from the rotations on the back end, they're going to find catch and shoot threes. Or those dunks if you don't, those lob dunks if you don't tag Gobert. So I would start with switching. And their counters to switching are mostly based on beating bad, poorly executed switches where the two defenders don't come together and make contact and they just kind of slip in between the two guys. Frank Vogel, of all the things he's good at, it's fundamental defense. If this team can execute switches well, that stops enough of those built-in counters that it's not like the plus-plus kind of offense that Utah is usually giving you, and I'd feel pretty good about beating them in a series. So I think that's the way I'd approach it, and I'm less worried about Trez in that scenario than potentially against other teams based on the X's and O's.
All right, so it's worryometer time. Based on what we've all talked about, I'm sure we'll revisit this again, of course, before it happens. Worryometer, though, out of 10, Tim. I think... because the Lakers, I think, have the right answer. I think Vogel can get there, but he has shown a propensity to be somewhat like half, maybe slow behind, like, you know, like one half of basketball behind doing things when he should. Could cost a game or two if you get behind the eight ball a couple times. So I'm at like a seven, I would say, because I think this is a good team. And yeah. Lakers, yes, full strength. I think, you know, take care of this team. But of the Western teams out there, this is of the handful of teams where I can see them. I can see them playing up to their potential, you know, as a good team, playing to their abilities, able to counter. So I can see it. I mean, I don't think it's going to, but it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Help calibrate me. So does seven mean the Lakers are underdogs, or it just means among the team? Okay. At what point on the 1 to 10 scale is it like a 50-50 for you?
To me, it's like an 8 through 10.
Okay. Okay. And to recap from the last pod, we talked Denver without Murray. And then
4.5 for me.
And they were, they were like 3s and 4s. Okay. I'd probably put Utah I want to say 6 because I think there are teams I'd rather play less than them. And there are like all of the X's and O's I would want the Lakers to do. They're very capable of doing. And I think it's not super creative stuff that I've like gotten in trouble with in the past where I'm like, oh, well, the Lakers can play big against Houston and then beat them up here and do this. And then they don't do it. So it doesn't happen. I feel pretty good about the Lakers doing what they need to do in that matchup. So I'll say 6. You said 7?
Yeah. 6.5, 7.
I think that certainly if the Lakers don't do what I'm hoping they do, this is certainly a team that can be like a 7-8 for me.
Like, again, any team who can make 23s in a game or damn near a half like they did the other night, like those are the teams that I just and, you know, obviously there's no, you know, 2018 Warriors around that really does that, or the Rockets for that matter. But teams are still shooting. You know, Utah is one of the best 3-point shooting teams in the league on volume and quality, it seems like. So that's what their game's built around. I think the Lakers have the rotation defense to, you know, help mitigate that. But damn, I mean, if a team goes, you know, 20 for 45 one night from the three, it's like say goodnight. Like, it's good luck catching them, even with the great defense.
Yeah, and they do a good job even against the switching, which is what I would be wanting to do. They're prepared for that. They understand they don't have a superstar, and they have a lot of built-in stuff to beat that in a way that they're going to continue to generate pretty good offense. Like ball screens and then off-ball screens. Like, if you're switching their pin downs, the guy who's screening instead of screening the normal defender, he's going to like take a step that way but then go screen his own man. So now the original defender is just kind of waiting for the screener to walk towards him, but he's not coming, and then the shooter's open. So they're well orchestrated, very coordinated with how they attack switching. If we were playing them next week, most of my prep would be watching film on how they've attacked switching. And I know they have the right counters, but figuring out like at what frequency are they making the right decisions? Because we've seen like the Lakers post offense, they have the right counters for extra help. It's a frequency thing. So what else is going on with Utah that either makes them resilient to that kind of switching defense, or is a really, you know, prime opportunity for the Lakers to take advantage of that? So I think that's the piece that could swing it for me from like a 6 to 8. But I like where we are at that 6-7 range.
Yeah. All right, Tim, let's move on to the Phoenix Suns. Right now they're second in the West.
Yeah, tell me why you'd rather play them, Tom.
So
I'm super scared.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so Phoenix Suns, third in differential, +7. They're expected to have 39.4 wins. They have 40. Looking at the, you know, kind of fundamentals, 7th in offense, 116.7 per clean the glass. 5th in defense, 109.7. What I thought was interesting, Tim, is that who do you think, at least as per cleaning the glass, leads them in on-off differential? Like, which
Dario
player?
Dario Saric.
Did you already know that?
I knew that because it's a bullshit luck thing that our luck adjustment takes care of.
Okay, so what does your luck adjusted have? Because I think this is an interesting... Their Dario Saric at center lineup has given a lot of teams trouble. The size, speed, the quickness, he could shoot... He's done well for them there, where this is the other version of the Lakers can play a 4-guard lineup with Markieff Morris at center and I think be able to keep up with this team. Mm-hmm. But like there's Chris Paul, great player, sets the table, half court offensive mastermind, right? Great from the mid range, good shooter. He can get to the rim. He can beat you on all three levels. And that's what's in this team's data, too. They're efficient from all three levels on the court. They take good shots. Devin Booker, great individual scorer. He's a guy who can, like a Donovan Mitchell. Who I think actually Booker's a better scorer, like individually. Mm-hmm. Book can get to his own spots, create his own shot, and he can create it for others. And they have shooters now of Cam Johnson, Jay Crowder, like previously mentioned, Dario Saric. They have guys.
Mikal Bridges.
Yeah, great 3-and-D kind of option on the wing to maybe guard LeBron. But ultimately, this team's small, and they do have a DeAndre Ayton, big, you know, athletic young center. But this team is small to me, and in the not so physical, I'm not worried about who's guarding LeBron or Anthony Davis at all. I see those guys being able to get to the rim at will, and this switchy defense with the Lakers might be one of the few teams that really don't care about your switchy defense. And in fact, you know, salivate at some of the potential switches they can come up with.
Yeah. So looking at how Phoenix does defending specific play types, they have the fourth best post defense, including pass outs. Again, Utah was 28th. They sent a bunch of extra help from different areas. It's a pain playing them. We've seen what it looks like. Not fun. If the Lakers don't fix their own internal offensive countering tactics stuff, this is a matchup that worries me in that respect, because they're certainly going to challenge you. And we've seen Vogel go through this in the past and previous years and then figure it out, but it could cost you a game or so. And you don't want to like gift a team a game because they're attacking something you've been weak at all year long. From an isolation defense, from perimeter ISO, they're actually dead last. And Utah is first at defending perimeter isolations. So it's one of those like, all right, well, it'll be more of a LeBron attack, Mikal Bridges off the dribble and attack the rim kind of series, more so than all right, we've got our switch, go get, throw it to AD and just kind of watch him get double teamed series. So that's interesting. Really good post defense, really bad ISO perimeter defense. Second best pick and roll defense, including pass outs, right behind Utah, who's first. These are two very, very good pick and roll teams, but they do it in different ways. We know Utah style, Phoenix's style, they'll be a little bit more varied. You mentioned the switchiness. They'll run some drop. They'll run some catch hedging. They'll show and recover a little bit. They play to a game plan. And that variance, that capability there is tougher to play against, because no matter like who the Lakers are throwing out and how we're trying to attack, they could be doing different things in different games. I bet they switch a bit. I bet they drop and go under ball screens. If we don't force them to switch, I'm a little bit more worried about this defense. If they do concede those switches, then I think there will be spots to, you know, pick mismatches and go attack, post up AD from like the high post so we can see the whole floor, and then have him be, you know, rising over guys that can't contest his shots or driving to the rim. But I think, the post defense and the pick and roll defense worry me a little bit. I don't want to play Phoenix because of those couple of reasons.
I don't believe you.
I don't believe myself. But no, do you get the feeling with this, like there are teams where it's like, yeah, I know Utah is good because of, you know, the offensive scheme and Gobert. I know the Clippers are good. They got that wing scoring, and like there are specific identities of teams. Phoenix to me, and this is as someone who hasn't been watching a bunch of Suns games, the success they have doesn't match my, you know, casual Suns fan, not Suns fan, but like I'm not watching a bunch of games. Like how are they doing this? What should I be worried about? What does a Suns series victory over the Lakers look like? And I struggle to get there. And that's part of it's probably just because I haven't watched a bunch of film. But I think just in general, the perception of a lot of Laker fans is this team is fraudulent and they're overperforming and maybe we don't need to be worried about them.
No, I love that. I mean, I did pick this team to I'd rather play. So, all right, let me then kind of switch roles and defend them a little bit. The argument is that with Chris Paul led team, and he's truly the leader now, like Devin Booker might be the best player in terms of getting his own shot, but Chris Paul is the leader and kind of organizer of that team.
And in fact,
absolutely. If you look at their fundamentals as far as where, like how efficient they score from where. So, third in effective field goal percentage in the league, ninth at the rim, first in the short mid, third in the long mid, first all mid, third corner three, 16 non-corner, and then 9 all three. Those are their accuracy per cleaning the glass out of 30. So all three levels, when they take that shot, they take high quality shots is what that says to me, Tim. Doesn't matter from what level it is. But if you flip it around and look, okay, so how often do they shoot from each place, right? 29th in frequency at the rim. That's not going to cut it against the Lakers.
Yep.
And you see them, like, teams who can exploit the Lakers in their pick and roll, be able to get those creators to the rim a lot. So Devin Booker, great, but he's going to pull up. And they're all their mid, they're seventh in frequency.
Yep.
Those are the shots.
I mean, Chris Paul, 90% of his pick and roll shots are, like, pull-ups. Like, Chris Paul's not getting to the rim a bunch anymore. This is a, like you're saying, this is a very, very much mid-range team. And we see that impact their free throw rate, which is second lowest of any team as well.
Yeah, not good either. So all these things, if you can limit some of those corner threes, fifth in frequency, you know, that's a lot of function of Chris Paul. When he does get to the rim, he's not shooting. He's going to pass out for a corner three. Mm-hmm. So all those things to me are very fixable in allowing them to take the shots that you're not worried about as much in those mid-range shots. So throw out Drummond to match up with Ayton. Let him rock some drop coverage. Hey, you want to dribble into a mid-range shot every time? Go ahead. But we're not going to give you corner threes. We're not going to let you get to the rim. You know, we're going to force you to play into this kind of shot over and over and make Chris Paul and Devin Booker beat you from mid-range.
Well, so I'll defend my stance. That's what they want to do. That they, these are like the mid range is bad.
I'm not worried about it.
True for a lot of players, but these guys are good at it. It's what, like, it's a good shot for them, right?
Is it beat you 4 times out of 7 in a playoff game? Good.
I don't think so.
Yeah. But that's where I'm like, go ahead, bring your worst. Come on, bring, like, let's go. If we don't let you beat us with those corner threes and free throws and, you know what I mean, like letting you get to the rim, I just don't see the scenario where Devin Booker scores 40 a night and the Lakers are, you know, in trouble in this in matchup in like any scenario.
And I see. So Booker, I think what I'm thinking about this team, too, is the lack of identity from my perspective has to do with some of like their shape-shifting abilities as well. They run a bunch of different ball screen coverages. Defensively, they can do a lot of different things. And they can go big, they go small. They can appear a lot of different ways. Offensively, it's similar where they can mid-range you to death, maybe not in a 7-game series against the Lakers, but they have score efficiently at the rim, not on high volume, but they've got Eaton out there as like a dump-off roll man post player. He's not elite at any of those things, but he's good. They have Saric and Kaminsky's over there as well as like pick and pop floor spacer kind of guys. So they can go different ways with their big men. They have a lot of dudes who are kind of finishers, Johnson, Crowder, Bridges. They're stationary shooters in our categorization. They're going to catch and shoot and knock down threes. But Booker's someone that they can use on ball and off ball. He can ISO. He can run the pick and roll. He can post up a little bit against smaller players, which for us, I'm not too worried about other than with like Schroeder, which wouldn't be his matchup. But they can use him in off screen situations as well, kind of in a Paul George kind of way where they have the on ball, but they're good off ball players as well. So that's where, you know, throw a Wes Matthews on him. Yeah, we're going to run him off the pin downs and flare screens, and Wes is going to struggle to turn those corners, and they're going to get either threes from that or him turning the corner and attacking the rim from that. So they have a lot of possible ways to attack the Lakers, and in a way where going into this series, you might have your starting game plan, but your finishing game plan by game 5, 6, 7, whatever it is, there's a good chance it's going to be a little bit different because this is a team I think that can throw a lot of different things at you. Again, it might not be enough to win, but they have options personnel-wise, schematically. I think they're coached well, and that is that unknown of that is a little bit scary compared to Utah, where it's like, all right, well, if you can make them play out of their game, which is this one thing on both ends of the court, you've broken them. That's where the fear of playing Phoenix can manifest, I think, is that shape shifting.
But to me, the Lakers have a unique lineup where they can match. They can either, you throw out Saric as backup five, you know, rangy, switchy, shooty, We can throw out Markieff Morris. Okay, that's not working. Keith isn't it? Isn't working. Throw in Montrezl Harrell to beat you in the other way.
Vogel didn't want to play, but I agree with you. But remember what we saw. You know, actions speak louder than words. Remember what we saw in an actual game was Vogel not feeling comfortable with him out there against Arch and playing small, and the Suns winning those minutes.
Yeah.
So that's one of those again where I'm like, well, I think we should be able to do this, but Frank clearly doesn't think so. So maybe we should, maybe I should listen and not be like, oh, well, we can, you know, do X, Y, and Z if they're not willing to do X, Y, and Z.
I believe so too. That was a game without AD for whatever.
That was a game without AD. That's a good point.
One of the first, I think, since he went out like for the second time.
I think that was the very, that might have been the very first game after the AD injury. So that's a good point because, I mean, AD is able to go out there and play against Arch just fine.
Yeah. I just not as worried. If you got Ayton, we got Gasol, Drummond, AD, right? I feel okay with some of those. Better, not as great about Mark. I don't think this is a huge Mark series.
I think Harrell versus Ayton is the only one. Like, he'll beat him on the boards and he'll post up where it's like a average post player versus a poor post defender. That's the one where I don't feel great about. Mark, I think he'll be fine against Ayton specifically. But continue making your point. Why don't you think this could be a Gasol series?
Oh, partly too, because I think of the athleticism gap between him and Ayton. Ayton does have a vertical element that can just put Mark in a blender. So I might prefer Drummond, you know, and obviously, again, Drummond is going to start when or if the Lakers play the Suns. So Drummond will be matching up with Ayton if this does end up happening. And I'm a lot more comfortable with that than I am against Gobert. But because I don't see Ayton as this physical domineering big guy the way Gobert could be in the boards on defense that you'd like a Gasol against. Where Drummond can, they're about like on the same plane physicality wise.
Mm-hmm. And you don't like the pick and pop floor stretching thing with Gasol or Trez or AD for that matter. That element of their game isn't trying to nullify a strong rim protector presence. And Ayton can defend the rim well, but he's not like that's a very, you know, get Rudy Gobert out of his game kind of approach. Yeah. I'm thinking now, so for the 5-man rotation, would you start? Well, I mean, you're going to start.
You have to start
right. But I'm thinking like, do you go after those Saric or like the other guy they have is Kaminsky? Either of those guys. Do you go after those bench minutes with Anthony Davis and beat the hell out of them in the post and then go Drummond Keefe for a lot of their 8 minutes? You'll still start with AD in the game, of course, but maybe, you know, shift the timelines a little bit. That's one potential approach. That's intriguing to me that I thought of just right now. But
yeah.
I think the Lakers do have some options, and I think this is much more of a Drummond series than Utah potentially would be.
But I mean, yeah, back to Utah, and this is obviously a theme because these guys are two of the most unguardable players in the NBA, but who's matching up with Anthony Davis? Like, okay, maybe they start Jay Crowder to take on LeBron. We saw how that went in the finals. It's okay. It's better than nothing, but it's not real. You know, you're not going to put him on it and expect to stop.
Right. Neither of these teams has a defender you feel great going one-on-one in the post against Anthony Davis. Gobert and Ayton might hold their ground a little bit, but I still am comfortable with AD going after them. For everybody else, both teams, either series, it's going to be a bring extra help kind of thing. And that's where Utah hasn't done as much and has been weaker at. And Phoenix does a lot of and is pretty good at. And that's at the, you know, I keep thinking like, all right, well, if the Suns do switch and we do try to attack it, they're just going to send a bunch of extra help. And then it turns into that Denver series or the Miami series in the finals where like we're getting mismatches. Like we're going at Tyler Hero with the LeBron James. Like we're going at Jamal Murray with Anthony Davis. But then there's that second defender and it becomes they don't let you play that one-on-one game. So with a lot of this playoff X's and O's tactical basketball, if you can't go beat someone one-on-one or if it, like that forces the defense to play you specific ways. And that's an advantage if you can take advantage of it. And the Lakers being able to do so is going to be a huge piece. And if they lose to either of these teams or any team in the playoffs, it's going to be one of the key elements is going to be probably missing threes. And then the other thing is going to be the Lakers post offense gets slowed down because extra help is brought and they're not countering well. Those are, I think, two for sure things that will happen if the Lakers lose a playoff series. And I think Phoenix does some of that that second element a lot more so than Utah does.
The other thing too, and this is real, even if it's a narrative thought, I think they got two guys. They got Chris Paul and Jay Crowder have ever really been in the playoffs before. And it's the game changes, the level of adjustments, the intensity. Is DeAndre Ayton, is Cam Johnson, is Dario Saric going to be able to step up in these moments? And it's a little bit harder to buy than a team even like, I don't know, like Portland. You know, Portland's vets, been in the league a while, even guys down to like Kanter. All these, you know what I mean? It's just hard to see the first year. Maybe next year, but already the Suns have outperformed what we thought they would be. So it's hard for me to... for them to outperform where we thought they'd be and expect that they're an established top three team in the West now. Mm-hmm. It's just a hard, it's all too much.
There's
too
a healthy skepticism in for a lot of the right reasons. Like we watch these teams year after year. This isn't a, you know, we're only looking at 2020, 2021 season. Looking years by, like there are teams that do well in the regular season, doesn't translate to the playoffs. And then why is that? They don't have the superstar player. Utah. They are young and inexperienced, younger coach, like haven't gone through those battles and had to be the head coach making these tactical adjustments, or the players haven't gone through that. Phoenix kind of has some of those flags. And I mean, for a lot of them, these cases, like we have this in our head because it's usually what happens, but they're of course outliers and you just don't see them until they happen for a lot of cases. So it's possible that what they're doing is very real. And I think there's a lot of merit to their approach. But I think you bring up a good point, and that is something that would be at play, especially against a team coming off a title with a coach that's just played all of these chess games against LeBron freaking James and Anthony Davis. Like, that would be a big element of the series.
It's tough. All right, Tim. So getting out of here really quick. First, worryometer on the Suns, or what do you got?
So I said 6 for Utah. Now I feel like I'm too low. Jeez. I think Phoenix for me is also a 6. I think Utah has more upside to be a 7, whereas I think Phoenix is more like a solid 6 to me.
I think I'm at like 4.5, 5 for really? Phoenix. Yeah.
Wow.
I just don't. Like, good luck. Chris Paul is going to be pissed off. He's going to yell at somebody after game 2. They're going to split they're going to be in Phoenix and go 1-1. And then like lose game 3 and game 4 is pivotal, and they just don't have the dudes to know what it takes to grind out a game 4, and they'll go down like 3-1, and then they'll like roll over in game 5 because they don't know what to do. Like I think they're good. I think they're going to be good, but I don't know, man. Chris Paul and Devin Booker playoffs. I don't know if it adds up the way it might in the regular season scenario. So I'm a little bit lower.
They've got their one hand, they're climbing up that mountain, and they've got one hand over like the top of Contender Mountain, but they haven't been able to pull the rest of their body up yet. Like they got the grip.
Yeah.
They're having a great year. They've got a lot of the right pieces. It just might take a little bit more next year to finally make that full leap as a team.
All right, Tim. So before we get out of here, we had a question from our Discord. I'm going to try and sum it up. Basically, Dennis Schroeder versus Talen Horton Tucker. How confident are you, 1 to 10, that Talen Horton Tucker will become a better player than Dennis Schroeder?
I'm very confident. I think, especially because they both play the same role offensively, they're both slashers. It's more of an apples to apples thing. You could say, all right, who's the better playmaker? And right now, 20-year-old THT is doing things that 20-year-old Dennis Schroeder is nowhere close to doing. And not many other players were. Like, THT, 86th percentile playmaking talent grade this year, 92nd percentile versatility is better than Schroeder's career high. Like, THT's seeing the floor better as a 20-year-old and spraying passes all over the place than Schroeder ever has. And better than any 20-year-old in our database other than LaMelo Ball, Ja Morant, Trae Young, Luka Doncic, Devin Booker, Emmanuel Mudiay, Devin Booker a second time. I guess he did it 2 years. And then Kevin Porter Jr. So that's some good company on the same level as SGA, De'Aaron Fox. When we look at the quality, the something that we've talked about with Schroeder is he's had low efficiency and low quality this year. THT's been a little bit better. He's had higher efficiency. He's at 86th percentile quality. He's getting good looks for players. He's not just passing because he has to, passing because the shot clock's low, passing because he doesn't have a look. He's drawing that defense in with a strong finishing and then finding dudes at a rate that is comparable to Trae Young, Luka Doncic, Ja Morant, Kevin Porter Jr., LaMelo Ball, SGA, Darius Garland's on here, Devin Booker again. No, it's only the first time for him. Kobe White, interesting, and Lonzo Ball. So, I mean, with both of those lists, in terms of seeing the floor well, getting high quality looks, that's really good company. And it's better than most Schroeder years. So I'd say certainly from a playmaking standpoint, THT's in a great spot, super young. The ceiling has to be way higher than what Schroeder has shown us so far. Schroeder at THT's age had A minus volume, C plus quality, D plus versatility, F efficiency, F scoring gravity. THT's better than all of those. Right now, except for the volume. So I think he's...
See, that's not something you can just put away. And I agree with you, by the way. I do think THT is on the path. But I have to say, growth does not mean more equals same output, right? So when THT were to get that volume, sometimes you learn from the mistakes that you make. And he's makes a lot of them, driving into multiple guys where there's no lane, you know, making kind of an overambitious pass that isn't even really the right idea, to be honest. But he's doing it less, so he has less opportunity to, you know, make those loud mess ups. And if he gets more opportunity, we don't know now yet if he is going to keep the same output. So that's something that is hard for young players, for any player, as you get more volume. I just have to say that volume isn't nothing.
No, that's an excellent point. And it helps that THT isn't starting from like nothing. Like he's thrown into the fire. Like he's getting a good bit of it right now. But you're right. Like it's just like shots. If you're going to go from 5 shots to 10 shots, you're usually not just going to be like, it's not just like suddenly you get more catch and shoot corner threes. Like you need to start creating things. It gets more difficult. So scaling up comes at an expense of like efficiency generally from a scoring standpoint. And I think it's similar for playmaking. He's had slightly easier looks than he potentially could if he were like some sort of lead ball handler with those sorts of things. So that's one element of this. I think defensively is another thing you look at. And I'd say that I believe THT has top 15 guard wing ceiling for defense potentially. And it might not happen. It might not be realized, but it is hard to be a dude with those kinds of that wingspan. What he's able to do in terms of being a playmaker defensively and disrupting players on ball, like point isn't of attack, something you teach. It's not something that your arms don't grow 4 inches once you hit the NBA at 23 years old or 22 or whatever. He's coming in with that physical skill set, and his weakness is actually similar to the weakness that Schroeder has, which is the off ball stuff. And I think that's one, encouraging because it's more fixable, but two, a note of caution because a guy like Schroeder has been weak at that his whole career. Yeah. He didn't come into the league weak at it and then, you know, linear growth and got better. Sometimes it doesn't happen. So if that's the case, THT is actually right now, he's already an above average defender from an impact standpoint. Maybe that's where he stays. But if that piece is fixed, and that piece is much easier to fix than some of the God-given talent that THT has from a physical standpoint and an instinct standpoint, that ceiling is certainly there. Whereas Dennis Schroeder, for as much as he looks good on ball, he's so weak off ball that for his career, he's always been about an average defender.
I think if you were to compare both players' best skill set, I guess, best ability, right? Dennis is like first step quickness, acceleration burst, and versus THT's just kind of ability to self-create and finish around the rim in unique angles and unexpected places where the defender just doesn't think they need to be, right? I think THT is already better at his best attribute than Dennis is. And, you know, THT's will take a step back three every once in a while that will look so fucking smooth that you just like your brain explodes with the possibilities. And then he'll miss one a foot to the left and like 6 inches short. That's so bad. You wonder how this guy's a professional basketball player sometimes. So his shot, you know, and it's not like Schroeder is a dead eye assassin or anything, but he's this like middling, like maybe slightly average, below average player. And THT isn't even that yet in the shooting. So
And Tishy doesn't even have like the mid-range shooting down right now. Yeah. Like Schroeder, the three is questionable, and he's kind of like a 2.5 level scorer.
Yeah.
THT right now is like a 1.5 level scorer. Like he's really good getting at the rim. And I agree with you that I think that skill for him getting to the rim and finishing at the rim in both areas, he at 20 edges out Schroeder now and Schroeder at his peak. And for the role they do, that is such a key skill set. And I mean, I've pulled up the data. THT's 12th this year in finishing talent, 6th at getting to the rim, 102nd at finishing to the rim, but that's with like one hand. and so there's A minus A grades. Schroeder at 20 was a B getting to the rim, D finishing at rim, C overall finishing. So like super great head start currently, you know, young THT versus current Schroeder, who's like in his prime years, still edging him out. And the only players that have beaten, there's only one player in the database at 20 years old or younger that had a better getting to rim rating than THT. And that was Dennis Smith Jr.
What?
Which I think is an interesting one, but his finishing,
I thought it was like Zion or something.
No, among guards, my bad.
No, you're
among
all guards. Good.
In terms of finishing at the rim, so second among everybody in terms of getting there for his age, for guards. In terms of finishing there, only Giannis, who, I mean, how you categorize him is, it can differ. LaVine, Tyrese Maxey, who's had an impressive year in that one specific way this year, and some others. And then Kobe Simmons, another interesting name. Those are the only guys that, from a finishing at the rim standpoint, match up better with THT. But just overall talent, like THT's like way, way up there. He's got both of those ends. Nobody else is matching him in both of those areas. So like he's creating his own, like it's like him and Ja Morant as like your best young finishing guards coming into the league at the age that they're at. So super, super great start for him in terms of just like starting really, really good at something, not compared to dudes his age, but compared to everybody.
All right, man. Well, I think that's a good place to park it for now. Let's come back this week. We haven't talked much about the AD's return on the imminent. We mentioned it briefly. He's out this next game against Utah, but I think it'd be fun if we could get on the horn and just talk about how the team could look with Anthony Davis for a few games back, at least as a Lakers number one, and you know, see if we can find stuff to expect, maybe come up with some plays or set schemes that could fit around him and Andre Drummond, which will be good to see for the first time. Yeah.
Absolutely, because that's the next big question. Once AD's back, what does Drummond look like? What is his role? How does he play? What are the sets? What are the actions? What does he do? And I think the range of outcomes is somewhat wide. So how the team approaches it will be really interesting, and we'll break that down. But we can try to get out in front of it and say, you know, here's what it might look like if we were running the show, which we're not. But yeah, to give you some things to look out for, that'll be interesting. The season's been interesting the whole time, even with the dudes coming down, being down, and Tom's making faces at me. There's been interesting stuff to watch. It certainly hasn't been compelling, you know, top level Laker basketball, but you know, the season's a journey for a reason.
I can't argue with that, but go give us a subscription on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you find pods, rate us, review us, you know, hit us up with that 5-star rating, and we'll give you the Discord link so you can put some questions in. We can try and get to one at the end of each show now.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's try to do one a show, get some more people in that dialogue. We were talking the like soccer, what's it, the Super League? That's what we were talking about yesterday, but it's usually basketball talk. But, you know, we'll chop it up about all sorts of things. So
yeah, when is the NBA going to make a Super League with the Lakers and I guess they'd need more
and
teams.
If you were doing the basketball version of it, it would be like the Lakers, the Knicks, the Celtics. Like the teams that the Premier League picked aren't like their best team, haven't been their best consistent teams recently. It's like, it's the brands. They're going for the brands.
It's the brands, exactly. It's the best. It ain't got nothing to do with it, my friend. Mm-hmm. The richest is the best in the Super League. But yeah, let's leave it there for now. We're already at quite a long pod, but we'll come back this week and dive deeper into this AD team.
Yeah, and once AD gets back, maybe we'll do some Twitch streams, some in-game stuff, get back to that, pull the digital whiteboard out.
I'm down.
Yeah, sweet.
Let's do it. So then we'll talk to you guys next time.